My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And you know, it was so nice to be picked up. It's been so long. Thank you, Jerry, for all your kindness. And I would like to thank Mary Beth and Jimmy for inviting me to this wonderful second annual Jersey Shore Roundup. I just love it. I love Jersey. I love you. You've been wonderful to me, and I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so honored to be with the speakers I'm with that I love very much. So thank you. And you know, this step is very important to me. It was one of my most important steps when I came in, because I came here after being 4 years in the mental institutions, in and out as a retread. And you know, but it wasn't just that. You know, when I read, it says the idea that someday, somehow, you will enjoy and control your drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Some of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And I certainly had done that. But my problem was also this. I wasn't born right. I just was not born right. You know, people used to look at me and say to my family, "She's not right." You know. In fact, I went to Scotland in October, and my two old aunties, who are the ones that came and took me off the street when I was living on the street, they said to me, "Has AA found out what's wrong with you yet?" I truly believe I was one of those in chapter 5 with grave emotional, that mentions that we had grave emotional and mental disorders. Now, I don't know what the nature of them were, but I certainly think it was part of the personality that was leading me to have to find sanity. You know, sanity. What is sanity? Sanity is a form of wholeness. I certainly was never whole. In fact, I think it comes from Latin sanitas, meaning wholeness. And I never ever felt whole. I never ever felt right. I was born on high alert. You know, I was just consequently my family used to jump up and down when I walked past, and then in school I did not do well because I was very nervous, and also they would tell me things that I would dispute. And then I'm like a lot of alcoholics, although Al-Anon never gives us credit. I had a high IQ. So when I'm very young, I'm thinking about things with this untrained mind, and then I found out that the world is just a little round planet spinning around in space. I went to the priest. I asked him to explain it to me, why this wasn't solid earth. Where was my soul? And he said, "You shouldn't be asking things like that. Why are you thinking about them?" Well, I did think about them. I thought on them and I dwelt on them. And I thought about death and I dwelt on death. And I just did not do well. My mind was a rambling thing. And it would ramble and ramble, and I would sit in classroom and I'd never listen to anything. And then I began to have relationships with boys when I was quite young. And what would happen there is we would have a smooch session, and then I would ask them what they thought about death and dying. Consequently, they used to run away from me. So, you know, just to put it in a nutshell, I always knew there was something wrong with me, and the reason I knew was because people were always saying to me, "There's something wrong with you." That was just it. But you see, the alcohol was, I never started going into the mental institution until the last 4 years of my drinking. Now, should I have had psychiatric help prior to drinking? Absolutely. I should have had, because I was definitely a wreck, like Bill Wilson. And, oh, you know, I love when it talks about Jim in the Big Book. When it talks about Jim in the Big Book, it says that, you know, he behaved much like a normal person. when he wasn't drinking except for a nervous disorder. Three lines down, he's in the insane asylum. It's not a big stretch, you know. It's not a big stretch. And I certainly identified with Bill Wilson with the panic attacks, because I had panic attacks at 13. Now, I truly believe that I had panic attacks at 13 because I was absolutely and completely obsessed in self. You see, I don't always think it's the alcohol that kills us. I think it is the unbearable, unsheddable burden of self. And I think that is part of the insanity of the second step. And that self tells me that I'm not enough. It tells me when I go into a room, you're all looking at me and judging me to be wanting. It tells me that I'm different. It was not a good place to be. So therefore, eventually, I tried everything to try and have a normal life. I had jobs that I thought would make me feel good. And then when I was nursing, they asked me to do my first body, and I had a panic attack and ran out the ward screaming. And the matron said to me, there's something wrong with you, and you're in the wrong profession. Then I got a job with British Airways. I'm flying all over the world, and the only thing is I'm on a plane with a lot of people. I don't like people. You know, it was a nightmare for me. Negotiating life without the wonderful 12 steps that I have, that has given me Appendix 2. You see, Step 2 is the beginning of what happens in Appendix 2, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and it's given me a power. Now, here's the thing. Yes, I am powerless. I was powerless. I read Step 1. I am powerless. But you see, what alcohol did for me when I first drank it was alcohol gave me power. The power to negotiate life. The power to walk around and look somewhat normal. When I began drinking, nobody was looking at me askance anymore. I was at last a part of society. I was a very happy person for a while with alcohol, especially since I was in Jamaica drinking 151 proof rum. That was the solution to all my madness. It just calmed me down beyond belief. I was very interested to know, too, how Bill wrote that second step. You know, in the original, I think it was in 1939, Akron and Cleveland were still using the four absolutes. But New York had the six principles, and only the last one mentioned God. And Bill talks about when he was writing, he was ready to write chapter 5. And he was in bed. He wasn't feeling good because four chapters had been written and everybody around wanted to be an author. Every member wanted to be an author. And his nose was out of joint because he didn't think he was going to be the author. We all know how that feels. I don't want to be a player. I want to be the main person. Otherwise, my self-esteem gets hurt. And Bill sat down with a foolscap and he started writing. And he said that to his surprise, unaccountably, he had put God in the second step. It just seemed to happen. It is one of those wonderful things that just seemed to happen in the formation of this divinely inspired program. And without this, I am convinced that I would not be walking around without... Now, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. All I'm saying to you is this. Since 10th of August 1984, my dry date, I have not been back in a psychiatric ward or a mental hospital, and I have not had any drugs in my system, any psychiatric drugs. And that's some kind of miracle for somebody like me. I am absolutely... You know that, don't you? More than most, don't you, Robbie? You're just like me, I know. So, you know, besides a seeming... You know, Bill wrote about faith. He said, besides a seeming inability to accept much on faith, he seemed to think that alcoholics had an inability to accept much on faith. What we needed was knowledge. And knowledge is something that we come to through getting to know ourselves and working these 12 steps. This is the most wonderful program for getting to know who you are. Being able to look at who you are, being able to say that of myself I am truly nothing, which is what I have done. As an early age now, I've told you that I never felt as if I belonged. There was no place I ever felt comfortable. I didn't feel like any of my peers. I did not feel like any of my family. I was waiting for the mothership to come beam me up. I mean, and then God, which this second step begins to address. The solution to the problem. Now, I was brought into a very good Roman Catholic home. They were wonderful people. And I was taught all the right things. And I was educated by wonderful Franciscan nuns who eventually had to throw me out at 15. Wasn't their fault. They gave me everything they had to give me. I was just too unruly and too crazy to be with them anymore. They tried everything they could to transfer their idea of God. You see, it is the idea of God that I got in here that suited me, not their idea. So at a very early age, I had thrown away the God of my understanding. I could get no peace. Not only that, every year my family used to take me to Ireland because I come by my strange mind, honestly, in my opinion. In Ireland, I mean, well, Freud said you cannot psychoanalyze the Irish mind. So, my family used to take me. I had an aunt living in Drogheda, which is just outside Dublin, and every year they would take me to Ireland. And there was this beautiful big cathedral in Drogheda. And they used to take me in and they sit me in the front pew. And on the altar was a glass case with a head of it, a head inside. It was the head of a martyred saint. His name was Blessed Oliver Plunkett. And he had been hung, drawn, and quartered by the English and then burnt at the stake about 200, 300 years ago. And all that was in this glass case was this black head with teeth. He still had his teeth. And my family used to say, sit there and study Blessed Oliver Plunkett. Because he really loved God. I thought, if he really loved God, it didn't do much for him. On page 44 of the big book, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Dr. Silkworth truly believed that it was a moral psychology that he had to apply to alcoholics prior to the formation of AA. That's what he told Bill, that they felt that they needed to apply some kind of moral psychology to alcoholics, but he didn't know how to apply it. They didn't have the tools. You see, Dr. Silkworth loved us, but he was trying to teach a spiritual program with a scientific solution or a psychological. You know, I certainly, because of the way my mind was working from when I was young, I had hung on to some philosophy. I also had, I don't know if you've ever heard of James Allen, As a Man Thinketh. And in there he says, mind is a higher power that molds and makes, and man is mind and evermore he takes. The tool of thought and shaping as he will creates 1,000 joys, 1,000 ills. He thinks in secret and it comes to pass. Environment is but his looking glass. No, I was believing for a little while that my mind was my higher power. which is a scary thought. Because it tells me in the big book that the problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body. And what is the mind? Well, you cannot x-ray the mind. The mind is not the brain. The old timers used to, and even the old Greek philosophers and other people, they used to say that soul was mind. That the mind was the soul. So you see, I truly believe I have a soul sickness. That's what I know today. I know that everything for me was lack of God, was lack of this great power that I have latched into today. When I came in here, life had taken me through alcohol, used me up, and thrown me away like an old piece of cloth. There was nothing left of that daughter my mother had given birth to that she had such great hopes for. My mother was the president of the Union of Catholic Mothers, and I was something that looked so foreign to her. My father had been a Franciscan monk, and he left the monastery through an altercation, not for any other reason. They were both such spiritual people. But you see, I had to find spirit first. Like Jung, spiritus contra spiritum. Spirit, alcohol, was my wholeness. That was my way to wholeness. Why is that? I don't know. I just know that when I was 25 years of age, I had been traveling the world, trying everything. Trying to fit, trying to belong, trying to find something that I could apply to my madness that would make me look the way you looked or make me feel the way you looked. And I had even gotten married. I thought if I get married, I'll be well. Well, that poor man married a figment of my imagination. He married nothing that was really there. And of course, that's going to show. And when did it show? It showed just after I had my first son, when I should have been happiest in my life. At 25 years of age, I have my first child, and I think I'm going insane. I think I'm going mad. Finally, after 25 years, I can't walk the earth anymore, and my mind is going to take over, and it's going to burst. And that I felt as if I was going to go into a vacuum. And that's when they gave me 151 proof rum in Jamaica. And that was when the magic happened. I don't know if it's the first drink, the second drink, or the third drink. See, alcohol is my solution until it doesn't work anymore. I don't want everyone to put up their hands who've had a nervous disorder prior to drinking. But we're not well even after we stop. And the greatest test of that is stress and relationships and just sometimes handling emotional situations. I don't come here not to drink. I come here because I like the life of sanity and meaning and purpose. And that was what I meant when I said to Jerry that I think God keeps those of us who are sickest the busiest. You know, Huxley called Bill Wilson the greatest social architect of the 20th century. And he was absolutely right. Because what Bill Wilson created for people like me, with the whole structure of service and what we do here, was something that psychiatrists couldn't give me if I'd been in there for 20 years. When I was in the mental institutions, they used to, for a while, they didn't define me as a chronic alcoholic because I looked like other things. Plus, I wanted to be a schizophrenic because I liked the Trazodon. And you know, we can look like that. I can. when I'm out there, I can get really weird. And what happens to me too when I'm out there drinking, I want to kill men. But I'm not like that today, Jerry. I'm a lover, not a fighter. So they had treated me with all, because, and of course I'm such a liar, I will lie to them. I will tell them that it's my three husbands. How many did I have then? Yeah. I think by that time I'd married three husbands, and I would blame it on them and their ill treatment and everything else. But it wasn't them. It was my madness. And you see, almost sitting in that mental institution, I got the same feeling I got when I first came here. That's what I used to. I was so sick that when I went into the mental institutions, and sometimes I was taken by the police, I was so happy to be in there. And you see, they gave me oblivion and a little quietness of mind. They gave me all the wonderful yum-yums. You know the yum-yums? The Librium and the Valium and all the yum-yums. The last time I was taken in there, now, you see, I've passed over a lot because that's not what I'm here to do, is to tell all my story. But what happened to me is, because of my alcoholism, I lost my beloved children. They were taken away from me in Jamaica by their father. Then I ended up in the street, living in Miami, thinking that not only was I mad, but also knowing now that I have whatever this alcohol thing is, and yet I'm between a rock and a hard place. I have come to the place where I know that I can't live without drinking, and I can't live with it. And God knows I tried time after time after time to find something that would relieve me and give me a little peace. And even being on the street, there my madness came in handy. It protected me. I don't know if there's any dead bodies, but that's not my fault. I was violent, I was afraid, and the one thing is when I drank, I didn't have panic attacks. I did not think that any God would want anything to do with me anymore because of the life I had lived. My life had been one of obsession with self, utterly and completely. There's a poet, an American poet, and she wrote something that absolutely defined. Her name is Anne Sexton, and she died of suicide. And she wrote this thing once that described my situation to a T. She said, "I have a body and I cannot escape from it. I would like to fly out of my mind, but that is out of the question. It is written in the tablet of human destiny that I am stuck here in this human form. That being so, I'd like to call attention to my problem. I wanted to leave my mind. I wanted to leave myself. You see, self is my problem, but I have the wrong sense of self. I don't know I have to get rid of that self. I am self-obsessed. I am my own ecosystem. There's nothing else going on. There's nothing else going on." And then eventually when my aunts came and took me off the street and sent me back to Canada, because that's where I wanted to go, and this lovely man tried to help me, really a nice man, and I tried to kill him. You know, I've said it once, I'll say it again, all my husbands had a nervous tic, you know, because I used to be drunk and I'd say, "If you fall asleep tonight, I'd kill you." I know. But I guess they thought I was exciting when I wasn't too bad. When I was in the mental institutions, I remember one time the psychiatrist said to me, I'm going to send you for an assertiveness training course. I said, I don't need assertiveness training. I'm in here because I tried to kill my husband. He said, that's aggressive. You alcoholics don't have enough self-esteem to be assertive. You don't think enough of yourself. He essentially spoke about the inflated ego and low self-esteem, because by this time he knew I was an alcoholic. Now, when I got out of there the last time, I had to go to court. And they gave me a document to read, which I have to this day. And that psychiatrist, who had been working with me for 4 years, had written to the court. And he wrote that in his opinion, I was suffering from 3 diagnoses: chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And I think that just about defines an alcoholic of my type, because it even uses the word abnormal in our book, in our literature. That's when it says that our family sense in some way we are abnormal. And when I got out of there and went to court, eventually got home, I was drinking myself sober. I had come to the place where alcohol was no longer working. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's a terrible place to be, because there is nothing left. There's no other power. The power of the alcohol isn't working anymore. What am I going to do? They had brought AA meetings into the mental institutions. And they used to say to me, do you have hope? And I was so full of drugs, I would say to them, I have no hope. I have no hope. Because, you see, I did not want consciousness. Consciousness and sanity go together. I didn't want that. I wanted the insanity of my alcoholic life that made life bearable for me. Now it's not working. What am I going to do? I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And that's when this man called Stan came. And he had 28 years sobriety, and he told me his story. And the thing he said to me was that I was an alcoholic, in his opinion, who was of the hopeless variety without the 12 steps of AA. He's the one that said to me, when I said, Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They fit any nut that comes through the door. So you see, hopeless and futility finally had me surrender. Hopelessness and futility. And the knowledge that of myself, I'd come to the jumping off place. I am so grateful for the gift of despair. I would not change my life. I wish I had not been an alcoholic mother for my children. I wish that my parents had been alive by the time I got to AA. But I wouldn't change one part of my journey. Because when I came in here, and eventually I told the old timers to throw all my medication down the toilet, and they would stay with me 24/7, and they did. And they told me that the highs would get lower and the lows would get higher. And then they told me that there's a few simple things I have to do. And after the first step, they took me to the second step. And I thought that was going to be such a problem for me. Came to believe that apart. They said, we're not asking you to believe in anything. We're just asking you to be willing. Just be willing. Do you feel hopeless without help? Are you beginning to feel any comfort with us? Do you think maybe you could just pray to God, whatever you perceive that God to be? Because they said to me that without something greater than yourself, you will never, ever overcome alcoholism. that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, and that God could and would if he or saw it. B and C. That is what, to me, is the whole essence of the second step. That is what opened up the doors for me. That and reading We Agnostics. And seeing that one day I could have this thing. Now, I don't even know when I started to believe in God. But this is what happened to me. I had had a slip. Bill Wilson had been my higher power. Because it was something greater than me. And I had a slip. And on the 9th of August 1984, some people came and they took me to a meeting. And that night, a little girl from AA spent the night with me. And then she said to me, "I'm going to leave you because you're a loser." My sponsor said, "You're a loser. And I only stick with winners and Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer." And I said to her, "I kneel for nothing." And then something said, "Think of your children's eyes." And what I thought about was the previous Christmas. I'd just gotten out of the mental institution one more time. I called my family in Scotland and said, "Could you phone my boy's daddy in Jamaica and see if he'll let me have my little boys for Christmas?" And my aunts called me back and said, "You can call him. He said you can have them if you don't drink." And my little boys came on the phone and said, "Mommy, Mommy, I can't wait to see you. Where have you been? We haven't known where you've been." And they told me the Christmas presents they bought, they wanted, and I bought them. And I got on the plane in Edmonton. It's a 2-hour hop to Toronto. I got on the plane in Toronto, bought a bottle of vodka before I left the airport, and drank that whole bottle between Toronto and Kingston, Jamaica. And when I got off the plane, I was so drunk that my little boys had been brought to the airport and I dropped down drunk in front of them one more time. And I remember seeing them being led away and all the Christmas paper lying on the ground. And that was what I thought about. The eyes of the child of the alcoholic, the broken promises and the broken dream, the madness of me. The madness that has made me do that when there's nothing else in the world I want but to go and see my little boys. Alcohol had me. It had me. It had taken me and used me up and turned me into something I don't even know what I was anymore. I felt like I wasn't even human anymore. And I knelt down. I truly believe this, that despair gave me clarity. That despair had me see. That despair enabled me to look and see what I had done with my life in this alcohol. And that I was insane. But there was promise for me. And I knelt down and I held her hands and I repeated the third step prayer after her. And that began my journey. I don't think I can tell my sponsees, because nobody certainly told me how to do steps 1 and 2. I do step 1 by being out there in the battlefield with alcohol. I do step 2 through my desperation, through my need for something that is so much greater than me. But you know, I truly believe this. In AA today, I have 28 years sobriety. This step means something different to me than what it meant when I first came in. There are some times when emotional situations come up today that I get a little crazy. I act in ways that my sponsor's not happy with. I'll give you an example. And it's usually to do with the emotions or something that's been upsetting me, and I've stayed in that situation past my past due date. I was working with a woman for 4 years that God had had me work with to test my serenity levels. She was a very difficult woman, a very brilliant woman. It was just her and I in the office, and sometimes she'd take up a folder and she'd throw it in the ground. And I didn't react because I was in fit spiritual condition. But I just said, don't do that. Anyway, it had been coming to a head. And I had been in Scotland. Every year I go to Scotland to see my family. I go to Aruba to see one son, and I go to Vancouver to see one. It was unpaid leave because I was part-time. So she hadn't been happy with the life. I was coming back from a trip, and I had to go into work at 1 o'clock, but I had to go to the dentist in the morning before I went. So when I went in there that day, she said, how was your holiday? I said, fine. She said, how was the dentist? I said, well, I've just used a month's income on my teeth. She said, don't tell me about your teeth. You go and see your family here, your family there. Well, I lost it. I think at some level I had made a decision that if she said anything to me, I was going to lose it. I went and I closed the front door of the office. And I took her inventory from when she was birthed. And she was afraid. And I, because you know what we can be like. When we let, you know, that rage. This seems to emanate from some deep place or sense, real or imagined, of betrayal. I think that is a starting point for the depth of rage, whatever. Some of it is just imagined. But there's a rage in there. And it came out. And she said to me, I think you should go home. Your teeth are probably hurting you. I said to her, why don't you go home? I've got work to do. And she left. I was so ashamed. I knelt down. I asked God to forgive me. I called my sponsor. My sponsor said, you have to go in the morning, make amends, and give her a week's notice. And I did that. And I did. I was able to leave in good grace. But you see, just for a minute, I went a little crazy. Because the situation that I was in is not good, I believe, for alcoholics of our type. I don't believe we're meant to stay in situations that are fraught with rage and anger, and where God suddenly just doesn't seem to be there for a minute. I can honestly say to you today that the consciousness of the presence of God is the greatest fact of my life today. I think it is the thing that has given me sanity and ability to walk the world without any medication in my system. It has given me the opening of this, that this second step opened up to me. It has just opened up a whole world of spiritual searching and seeking and different levels and dimensions. But you see, no matter how spiritual I get, I never rise above human being. And it is when my humanness comes in and I start thinking about me and my ego, is God out? That's when God is out all of a sudden. And I no longer look at this woman I'm working with as a child of God. I look at her as somebody that I want to scream and shout at. Michael was talking to me about the mailboxes. That was another time when I had, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I certainly get that. I get that because I don't drink anymore. And I get that because I truly believe that God has such infinite power in my life. And that God is deep down inside of me. Deep down inside of me and with me whenever I am there with God. But sometimes life will take me away. I was coming back from a conference a few years ago, and it had been a wonderful conference with Clancy and Johnny H. And you know those conferences where you just feel you've suddenly reached some seventh dimension? Not a fourth dimension, a seventh dimension. You know what I'm talking about, Ralph. It's a new spiritual level, you know. And I was walking through the airport, and I thought people are just... I was smiling at everybody because I thought... Yeah, you know, I thought, now I'm completely changed. I'm a spiritual being. Those old resentments, and they're all gone. And I want to just glow with the Spirit. You know, I want to just... And looking at people in the airport and smiling at them, and they must have thought, she's a cook, you know, but I just... So this is my great spiritual condition, and I'm sitting on a plane in the airport, and we take off, and there's a lot of turbulence. And I said to the woman next to me, suddenly God is just disappearing a little bit. I said to the woman next to me, there's a lot of turbulence. She said, oh, you're safer here than you are driving. I said, not me, I'm not. When I'm driving, I'm in control. So now you know God is just about gone completely out of my consciousness. At that time, I lived 2 hours outside the city. And I got in very late. There was a lot of fog. And by the time I got in, it was 2:45 in the morning. I was living in a gated community. I decided to check my mail. As I'm going towards the mailboxes, because they're all outside under this big parapet, I felt something touch the side of my car. I thought it must be a deer, because there's deers up there. And I put my foot in the brake, I think, but I hit the accelerator. And I go all the way into the mailboxes, and they all come crashing down, parapet everything. Now, from the fit spiritual condition of new levels that I had left the States in, my first thought is, you better get out of here. So I drive into my garage. Whew, nobody saw me. I look on my car, there's no front left on my car. There's a wonderful Irishman, and he's one of those soldiers you were talking about in AA, and he lived 3 doors down from me. And this now is 3 o'clock in the morning. And Dave just died. I lost a great friend. I phoned up Dave, and I said, Dave, I explained to him what I did. He says, Mary, you have to go over and make amends and let them know it was you. He said, I'll walk with you. So Dave and I walk over to where all the mailboxes and the mess is lying there. And all the neighbors are out now in their house coats. And they're standing there. And they're all saying, it must have been a drunk. How my behavior can change if I'm not in fit spiritual condition. How my behavior can change. You know, my gratitude for this step is beyond even telling you anything about from this podium. I have a life of meaning and purpose and sanity today, most days. I know what to look for. I know that alcoholism isn't just about drinking. If alcoholism was just about drinking, why would we need the 12 steps? You know, if alcoholism was just about drinking, in my first year when I went to 3-4 meetings a day, I would walk in and the chairperson would say, did you drink today? I'd say, no. He'd say, okay, come back at lunchtime. I'd come back at lunchtime. I'd come back at 6. I'd come back at 10. Did you drink today? Nope. Okay. And at the end of a year, I wouldn't have drank, but I'd be dead. And on my tombstone it would say, she didn't drink, but her head blew apart. The problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body. It centers in the mind, not the body. It seems to me that the way this wonderful program came together with people like William James, that they used some of his stuff. Because William James, essentially, in the varieties of religious experience, was speaking about drunks, skid row people who overnight had had a complete change of personality. And he found the common denominator in them finding God was absolute and complete despair. where their way didn't work anymore. That is why I say that the depth of despair allows you to see and also to open up to God's grace, which is such a wonderful thing to have. In the second step, when I'm believing that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity, I am putting every part of what I have in this God that I still don't have any comprehension of. God is anything the intellect is not. I cannot understand God. But it is in the beginning for me, the step was that I was looking at all of you. And the people around me believed in God. And they did not have to drink anymore. And I believed them when they told me their stories. So I was told, all you have to do is to become willing. Become willing. And I certainly had had enough pain in my life and created enough pain in the lives of those who love me to want to change. And I think that's the essence of it. The essence of the second step also is saying, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to change. And if it is a power, then I am willing to go along with whatever power is there and is keeping all of you sober. When I said to you that the consciousness of the presence of God is the greatest fact of my life today, I have not, it's only three times in 28 years I've felt like I was having a panic attack. And I have been able to pray it away. I have not, as I said, had any psychiatric medication. But I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm saying for me. They told me that I would have to be on medication for the rest of my life. When I came in here and the old timers told me, Mary, you're here because you're not all there. And they laughed because they knew that about themselves too. And I remember too what they told me was, they said in the early days, the members used to be brought from the asylum. That was where we used to bring them from. And through working these simple steps, which are God-given. You know, when I read about Bill saying that suddenly God had appeared in the second step, that is the great mysticism. That is the great psychic things that Bill spoke about. This is God's hand. I'll finish by saying this. There's sometimes there's these coincidences that happen in my life, and I'm not going to get into all of them, but I find that the more sober I am, the more I look out for them. And a wonderful thing happened to me, because you were mentioning the Bill W. documentary. I had been somewhere speaking, and I was tired, and I had to change planes in Newark, and I was saying to myself, I wonder if what I do really helps anybody. I'm sure we all ask ourselves that from time to time, if what I'm doing, if this really helps anybody. And I was looking for a sticky bun and couldn't find the one I want. It's always the answer for me. Anyway, I go into this restaurant with these questions in my mind, and I look down at my feet, and there's a postcard advertising the Bill W. documentary. They say coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. Maybe I'm a little mystical because of my Irish roots. I don't know. But I just truly believe that coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. It's about God coming up and giving me a little jab in the ribs and saying, hey, keep doing what you're doing. You're a lot better than you used to be. And this is my world you're walking in now. So that's about all I have to share with you on this step. As I said, I don't believe you can tell anybody how to work this step. I came to it through very gradual processes. But what it has done for me is it has recovered me from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Absolutely hopeless condition of mind and body. Nobody in my family anymore feels too disturbed when I'm around. You know, they're amazed by what Alcoholics Anonymous has achieved. I have been at weddings with my ex-husband and he doesn't kind of shrink away from me anymore. So my debt can never be repaid to Bill and Bob. And I thank you so much for having me here.